This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. A well-known news story a few years ago focused on a school teacher in Virginia who developed a brain tumor, and it changed his personality. It actually caused him great distress. It caused him to have pedophilic desires. And when the tumor was removed, he seemed to return to his old self. And that raises an important question. On what basis do we say someone is responsible for their actions, and how much control do we have over what we call our intentions? In the not-so-distant future, neuroscientific evidence may be as prevalent as DNA evidence in the criminal justice system, and that could answer these questions of personal responsibility. It could predict a criminal's likelihood to recidivate. But it could also cause us to jump to conclusions that are difficult to revoke, and it could invade the privacy of our thoughts. We're talking about neuroscience and criminal justice, and we're joined by four experts from Duke University. Walter Sinnott Armstrong is a professor of practical ethics. Welcome back, Walter. Good to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Scott Hutel is a professor of psychology and neuroscience. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Nita Farahani is a professor of law, genome science, policy, and philosophy. Hello, Nita.
Delighted to be here.
You're very busy. Good of you to take out time from all of that activity. And Ahmad Hariri is a professor of psychology and neuroscience. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure.
I know you're all busy. But Nita, let me start with you. That example I just mentioned, it really does raise this question of personal responsibility. To what extent does the law allow us to say, you know, my brain, maybe something's wrong with my brain, and that's why I did what I did?
There are a lot of different ways in which a criminal defendant can make that argument and bring in evidence to say my brain made me do it, and to try to show past evidence of brain trauma or a brain tumor or something like that. So there are quite a few ways in which a person can make that argument, whether it's about whether or not they should be convicted of a particular crime for which they were charged, or whether or not they should be punished as severely as somebody who doesn't have that as an excuse. So there's no legal prohibition per se on bringing that kind of evidence in, although there are a lot of things in law which try to prevent the use of bad science in the courtroom. And so there are ways in which judges serve as gatekeepers to say that science doesn't quite, you know, hit the mark yet of actually having enough validity to be introduced into the courtroom.
Yeah, it puts a lot of pressure on judges who went to law school and may not have studied neurobiology. Walter, do you see a distinction between sort of our personal culpability and a brain injury or a brain trauma?
Sure. When someone decides to abuse a young child and they don't have any kind of tumor that would indicate a lack of control or a lack of awareness of what they're doing, then they're in a very different situation than somebody who has a tumor who loses those desires and becomes law-abiding and feels bad about what they've done. It's a totally different situation. Now, how you draw the line between that extreme and clear case of a tumor and the normal case of a pedophile who's causing damage with no excuse whatsoever, that's a really tricky question.
Well, Nita, sometimes the law determines the level of severity of a crime based on intention, like voluntary manslaughter, right? Can neuroscience shed light on what is now this kind of very subjective task of determining intention?
Well, there are a couple of ways in which neuroscience potentially could do so. So first, I'd say there are plenty of criminal defendants who are already using neuroscience to try to argue that they didn't have the requisite kind of intentionality to commit a crime. So if the crime requires planning or premeditation, which the highest level of murder requires, for example, and they can show that they have some reason that it's harder for them to plan and harder to premeditate, and they're more likely to act on impulse or out of rage, then they'll argue they don't have the necessary intent for first-degree premeditated murder. And they might be convicted, and sometimes are convicted, of second-degree murder, which carries with it a much less severe punishment. But, you know, it's pretty hard to imagine, since what we care about is the moment at which somebody committed a crime, what was their mental state? And we're not all walking around with real-time neuroimaging attached to our heads to be able to record and then push play later and say, this is what my mental state was at the time of the crime. So it's a lot of inferences that we're trying to draw when we're looking at different types of neurological testing done weeks, months, or years later about what a person's mental state was at the time they committed a crime.
But the science is getting us to a point where the where what you described is not impossible. We might all be wearing those monitors as a matter of course. So let's sort of push this conversation a little farther. Ahmad, is this something that we should aspire to have the ability to record what we recognize as intent at the moment of the crime?
It's a difficult question for many reasons, Frank. I think some of those reasons have nothing to do with the science, but rather where we want to be as a society. You know, what lines are we willing to cross? You mentioned privacy. Are our thoughts, our private things that should be protected? Is the technology going to get to the point where we can actually read thoughts, we can predict behavior before it ever happens? It's not anywhere in the near future, that's for certain. But we are getting to a point where we can measure the brain and measure neurobiology in ways that help us understand certain trajectories that may lead individuals into trouble. They may cause individuals to be at increased risk for suffering from depression or an anxiety disorder if they experience a stressor. Or in the context of stressors, those brain markers may help us predict who's more likely to act aggressively, to lash out. So it's in the context of predicting future behavior where I think we are at a point where we're inching along and inching forward in a way that may one day be useful. More so than capturing a person's mental state at a moment in time, especially after the fact. It's one thing, as Nita said, to be able to record it in real time, but it becomes next to impossible currently to look back in time and from measures of neurobiology know what an individual was thinking and even their experiences.
Well, I want to talk more about this ability to, perhaps to predict tendencies. But first, Scott, I want to ask you to talk about a case called Roseman versus the U.S. and how that case raised the issue of a person's responsibility for unintended consequences.
Right. So this is a recent case that's gotten some attention because of what it implies about how we should think about questions of responsibility. The basic framework of the case is that an individual was in the presence of a crime being committed, a use of a gun and a felony, and indicated that he didn't intend for that particular crime to have taken place. And the idea was that the crime is established in one sense, but whether or not he is culpable for this accessory type crime depends upon whether or not his intentions matter for his later convictions. And one of the challenges for this is that intention is something notoriously difficult to assess. It's very challenging for us to move beyond the simpler cases of were you present, did you engage in the action, to the more difficult cases, what was your mental state at the time of the action, and then did that mental state correspond to the legal definitions of intentionality?
Well, and the legal theory that governs in many of these cases in many states is, look, if you're participating in an activity that could very likely have an outcome that is fatal, then if it happened that way, whatever you thought going in, you're responsible for the bad outcome.
Right. And he's, in this case, he is claiming, and as I believe is still being currently resolved by the Supreme Court, that his lack of intentionality to commit this particular crime, despite his willingness to be involved with the other crimes, should affect whether he's considered culpable. And so what's, I think, particularly challenging is trying to get a better handle on what we mean by somebody's intentionality, which would be this core concept that's going to pervade all aspects from sentencing to, in some cases, whether or not somebody had committed a criminal act.
And before we get to the technology involved in that, there's also a question of human brain development. And, of course, age makes a huge difference because our brains are changing all the time, right?
That's right. So we now know that people often focus on the entire brain, but of course the brain matures in very different rates. The area that we most commonly associate with control of behavior is prefrontal cortex. It's about a third of your brain, the front third. And depending on how you define maturation, it matures at least through the teens, and some aspects of it still mature into the mid-20s. That all said, if we think about somebody who's a teenager, they're often really good on many tests of prefrontal cortex function. So they're actually extremely good on how fast they can respond or categorize things. So it's a more complicated picture to say than just the brain isn't fully mature until you're in your mid-20s. the brain is enormously complex and it's maturing in very different ways over the entire lifespan.
So can we ever get to the point where we could trust a technology that would say, I'm convinced that you had the intention of creating this outcome? I mean, because it's, first of all, kind of a subjective question to begin with, intent. We make up this concept. And then later, the technology to measure it is made by people who have their own biases going in.
Can we ever get to that point? That would be a guess about the future. You know, if you think 20 or 30 years ago, trying to predict where we are now in neuroscience would have been pretty far off, I think. There are amazing things that have happened that nobody thought would have been accomplished. And so what's going to happen 20 or 30 years from now is difficult to tell. But it's at least in principle possible. You can imagine how neural scans could be used to determine what someone intended at the time. For example, if there's a neural signature of surprise in a case like this, well, he's surprised that this happened at that point when they see pictures of it. If there's a neural signature of that, it's in principle possible to pick it up. Don't ask me how to do it. That might take 20 or 30 years. But I don't want to rule out that possibility and say that it can't happen because I've been surprised so many times before.
We are talking about neuroscience and criminal justice with Duke professors Nita Farahani, Ahmad Hariri, Walter Sinnott-Armstrong, and Scott Hutel. And on the state of things, we will continue that conversation from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about neuroscience and the criminal justice system, Duke professors Nita Farahani, Ahmad Hariri, Walter Sinnott-Armstrong, and Scott Hutel, all with us. Nita, let's talk about biases that are built in. I think that's going to be sort of dominate the rest of our conversation. But even in the criminal justice system now, jurors come to the trial with their own prejudices. Sort of tell us how that plays a part in this whole process.
Yeah, so for a very long time, we've known that the composition of the jury matters a lot for what kind of a sentence a person can expect to get and what kind of a hearing they can expect to get. In the past, we had a lot of problems where you had jurors who were all white jurors, for example. And when you have the majority of people who were on trial actually being African-American, this cross-racial issue was really problematic. And a lot of studies have been done to show that the bias, oftentimes implicit, that is that the jurors don't realize that they're biased, and they in fact may not be, you know, racist in any kind of way that we think about that word, that the results in cases were very different. So if a white jury had a white defendant, the sentence was often lighter and the rate of conviction was lower than if there was an all-white jury and there was an African-American defendant. And that's just one of the ways in which bias can occur. It's how evidence is approached, how witnesses are actually listened to, the degree to which you credit a witness or believe that they're lying or telling the truth. When a jury looks at a defendant who may have really flat affect, they don't respond at all. They don't react at all. The perception that a jury may have is that that's a really evil person. So there are a lot of different ways in which jurors' perceptions of the defendant, of the witnesses, and even of the lawyers and judge in the courtroom can really play a significant impact in what they decide to do as the outcome of the case.
And there's research on the difference between implicit biases that you were talking about and explicit biases. So tell us about that.
So this is not my area of specialty, so I'm going to defer to the experts and who are here with me, who are the scientists, to really talk about it. But I'll speak about it just briefly in the ways in which we've been thinking about it in the legal system and then turn it over. So implicit biases, you know, when you do voir dire, this is the process that a lawyer goes through in interviewing each of the different potential jurors to figure out which juror you should have on the panel. What they're doing is they're trying to figure out what the biases are and figure out, you know, is this person a philosopher? Is this person a homemaker? Is this person a physician? How does that play into how they're going to actually hear the evidence and react to it? And what they're really trying to get at is some of the implicit biases, things that people don't realize influence their decisions. But over time, through studies, we've discovered that they can have a really significant impact on the cases. And so that's very different than a person who says, you know, I don't like young people. I don't like old people. I don't like, you know, pick your type of person or pick your type of crime. Or, for example, example, in death penalty cases, a person who says, I would never apply the death penalty. These are explicit preferences that they're able to voice and acknowledge and know. And a lot of times it's what's going on beneath the surface that a person isn't even aware of themselves that's really driving their decision making much more than those explicit preferences.
And there's some really interesting research on this, too. And it turns out that you can actually work with people with explicit biases, right? A little bit better than people who haven't articulated them to themselves.
I can say a few words, Frank. One of the areas of the brain that we study is called the amygdala, and it's designed to help us learn about our environments. And it does a number of things, including helping us respond to threat. One of the types of environmental stimuli we encounter that is initially perceived as threat is novelty, newness, can be a threat. So we know that the amygdala actually shows an implicit bias, for example, a race bias or what we call an out-group bias, where the amygdala, which helps us learn about threats and other things in our environment, shows a stronger response to images of out-group faces. So if it's a Caucasian research subject, you would see a stronger amygdala response to an African American face as opposed to another Caucasian face. And this is something that we've seen consistently. And as Nita said, it's not a bias that necessarily is reported by the individual. And this is one of the very interesting areas where neuroscience may actually be closer to a point to informing and at least uncovering certain biological or brain biases that could not otherwise be assessed with self-report or other standard measures. The important thing to add is that for all that we've been able to study this bias, it seems to disappear with simply familiarity. As an individual becomes more familiar with the images or with the stimuli that they're being presented, there is a decrease in the response of this brain structure, the amygdala, and concurrently a decrease in the threat that's perceived from this initially new stimulus.
Kind of makes sense, because if the amygdala's job is to tell you, watch out for the other, and they're you get to know them, they're not other anymore. So
right.
It relaxes.
The challenge is that this initial response of the amygdala puts pressure on the decision-making parts of the brain, like the prefrontal cortex. And so it creates a charged environment where it otherwise may not be necessary and then can bias the decision-making in ways that could be incredibly detrimental and unfair.
And, Scott, there are also ways in which juries and jurors are swayed by witness testimony, right?
That's right. So one of the most powerful things that can influence is our stories. And if you think about why we relate to that, it's because somebody else is connecting to us in some way. And we have, as part of sort of a broad social system in the brain, we are very attuned to detect someone else who has goals and desires and try to understand whether those goals and desires are relevant to us. And to the extent that to recognize that other person's story as something that's meaningful, it can be much more influential than simple facts or data about a crime or even past evidence that was presented a while ago. The narrative tends to carry, and we recognize that's because, and it's jumping up a little, it's because our brains want to simplify the world around us to something more manageable.
Or they may want to complicate things and create a very deep and complicated ideology to which we can all relate.
Well, we create those for ourselves over time, but what is really striking is that those complicated self narratives are going to be countered by the simpler ways in which we deal with the world around us. You can take an amazingly complicated court case with weeks of testimony and literally thousands of pieces of evidence, and we can all imagine cases where it gets distilled down to some simple rule that ended up guiding the person's decision. And across many, many different sorts of decision tasks, people will take huge sets of evidence and distill it down to some smaller story that makes sense and allows them to deal with the world around them.
Well, Walter, then, is all of this pursuit of neuroscience in the service of criminal justice a fool's errand, in that if we are story-making beings? That's our particular talent. And so you can give me all the facts you want about, climate change, and I can come up with a counter-narrative because it just doesn't suit my ideology.
Well, I think there are different types of stories, and there are different types of science, and there are different types of people. So I don't think it's a fool's errand. It's not going to affect everyone. And some people are going to go for stories against the data. But some people will actually listen to the data. And even those people who think more in terms of building a narrative around the crime, are going to be affected by the data. Because if you're told that this person has a certain brain condition which makes them impulsive, then you might end up thinking about the story differently than if you were not given that neural data. So I think, no, it's not a fool's errand. The neuroscience can actually affect the way jurors think about the case.
Well, Nita, you talked about the way attorneys are wise to look for the cues and look for the biases in their jurors. So does this become a kind of an arms race? The better armed we are, the more data we have, the better skilled we are at choosing the prejudice of our choice or the juror of our choice?
Well, that's the kind of pessimistic view of it, which is we use it as an arms race. The more optimistic view, I think, is that it improves the accuracy and decreases the errors in the system. So while it's true that both sides of the system try to arm themselves with as much information as possible to try to pick the biases that make sense to them, to the extent that both sides know what's happening, it isn't as if just the defense attorney gets to go through the jurors and pick out which one. It's an iterative process. The prosecutor goes, the defense attorney goes, it goes back and forth. And so ideally what happens is you end up with the most balanced possible jury rather than one that is just one-sided versus the other. So I think the more we can ferret out these different types of biases that are underlying the system, the better off we are, particularly since one piece that we haven't really talked about is that it's especially with implicit bias, where people aren't aware of the biases that are affecting their decisions and oftentimes will be horrified to learn the types of biases that are affecting their decisions, particularly some of the ones, you know, where your amygdala is activated and you're making decisions that really are very unfair. If you tell a person about the likely implicit bias they have, simply instructing them about it may help to de-bias them. And so one thing we could imagine, and people are already starting to talk about in the legal system, is whether or not judges could give instructions to jurors and tell them, look, you know, I'm giving you a lot of different instructions about how you should actually think about this case. One thing you should be aware of is you probably have a lot of implicit biases. So, you know, you may have problems hearing from the defendant. You may judge the defendant in a particular way. You may judge the different witnesses in a particular way. And telling them that seems to improve the accuracy and decrease the errors in the system.
Is that true? Because, you know, you've heard the phrase, I'm not a racist, but.
Right.
And you know that the next thing out of their mouths is going to be the most horrible racist thing you've ever heard. So,
right.
I mean, nobody's a racist, are they? And if the judge said, now you might be, I'm sitting there saying, yeah, I know those 11 are, but not me.
So I'm going to be optimistic on your statement of nobody is a racist, are they? And to say, I hope that that might be true. And I hope that we could simply tell people that when the next words that come out of their mouth are actually incredibly prejudicial, that by pointing it out to them, it helps them become less prejudicial.
But that's really the point of my question. Can the judge make a blanket statement to 12 or 13 people in a box? Or do I have to detect somehow your particular bias, demonstrate to you that what you thought was not a bias in fact is, and then once we've gone through that process, is that the moment at which you have aha, or can I really
it might, you know, it probably is most effective to give each individual person, but what you're doing is not saying, look, I have detected in you an implicit bias. What you're saying is, here's research that shows that all of you are likely to have implicit biases that you are utterly unaware of. So you are blameless in having these biases. So calling them bias doesn't mean that you have somehow that you're a bad person, that you're acting in prejudicial ways that are explicit and that we can condemn you for. It is something you're utterly unaware of, and simply being aware of it is going to make you a better person. So I think it's something that you can actually generalize and say to people and let off even the person who truly is prejudiced, right, who says, no, it's not that I'm an explicit, prejudicial racist. I'm an implicit one, and I'm going to fix that, right? So I think it's something that can work neutrally with all of the jurors.
I certainly can't see any reason it would hurt for everyone to hear this.
And yeah.
The interesting thing, Frank, is that simply asking the jury to consider that they may have this bias and to have them begin to think about it, what does it mean, even labeling the bias engages systems in the brain, in the prefrontal cortex largely, that function to quiet that amygdala signal. So making, again, the context less emotionally charged and allowing for more kind of careful decision making and a process that in the end may be more aware of the evidence and not biased by attitudes and implicit reactions.
Apart from being able to see what's going on with the amygdala and its response to self and other, how skilled are we? How far along are we at being able to detect these kinds of other sorts of biases?
That's a very good question, Frank. I can tell you that there are certainly areas of neuroscience where we have established a certain level of confidence. There are fewer than those areas which we are still in a largely exploratory sense. But you know, one of the critical issues that we're now, after a long time of kind of running away with ourselves and with our technology, grappling with is the reliability of the measure. That is, if I measure your amygdala response at one point, is it going to be the same later in time? In other words, am I confident that that measure of your amygdala is telling me something about the way it functions generally? We have made progress in that domain when it comes to looking at the emotional brain of individuals, their response to threat, their response to reward. And to a certain extent, we understand signatures in the brain that are associated with behavioral control, the ability to regulate an impulse. So those things we are, again, inching forward, establishing guidelines against which we can compare individuals' brain responses to a norm, for example, and from the differences we observe, predict something about that individual.
Scott, how about you? How do you feel about how we should understand both the strengths and the limitations of neuroscience?
Yeah, I think one way to think about neuroscience today is that we have incredibly good data about how the brain is structured, its organization, and how different things we might care about, memory, all the way from memory and perception to prejudice, how those are organized within the brain. But we know that based on aggregate data, often from many studies in different parts of the world from lots of people. The question of whether we know where, say, fear is represented in the brain is a very different question from whether this person was fearful when they saw a particular stimulus. So that second part, which Ahmad alluded to, where we're trying to take one person and make a judgment about them, is extraordinarily difficult. And it comes from the challenge of both not being able to measure the brain signals with perfect precision, but often with not even knowing the psychology with perfect precision. So if we take something like bias, bias might be readily elicited in some cases by, say, showing people photographs of somebody from a different race. But recognize that signal you might evoke is not necessarily bias per se. It's a brain response. And people could show that brain response without ever having that brain response in the amygdala or another brain region going anywhere to influence behavior or even thought. So we may not have we're still working on it, but we may not have a psychological concept well enough to find that we can then know whether it matters for behavior yet.
And it would seem to me, and I'll ask you all this question, if you go back to the first example, that news story about a brain tumor causing pedophilic impulses, suppose there was something less obvious going on with that individual, and they measured on your scope all of the indicators for intent or whatever culpability they would be responsible for, and we didn't know this other thing was going on, right? Yeah.
I think this is particularly dangerous. You see something that echoes this in genetics now, where the absence of genetic evidence is seen by people as evidence for a conclusion. And one really dangerous thing would be if we had the absence of say, a functional brain marker for impulse, a lack of impulse control, to say this person really has good impulse control. We actually wouldn't know that, the way the techniques work. So in the short term, our best case is to be able to say there's evidence for something bad. But we're very rarely going to be able to say that we can know that a brain is perfectly normal. It's not even a well-formed sort of statement in many cases.
And I wonder about this other phenomenon that we're familiar with. Were you about to say something?
I was about to say something, which is I just wanted to say that there's this phenomenon, the danger that Scott is talking about, we're already starting to see in civil cases rather than criminal cases. So one thing that people are really hoping for and latching onto in neuroscience is that there's objective proof. Like suddenly we can see what's happening. We've been trying to guess at it all this time, but here's the, you know, proof in the pudding. And in civil cases, what's happening is, you know, suppose a person has been in a car accident and they say, look, I suffered from significant whiplash and my head hit the windshield. And then they have brain imaging done and you don't see anything. In civil cases, they're actually using the absence of information showing up on a brain scan to say, look, the person's lying. They don't really have a brain injury. They didn't really suffer. They don't really have headaches. And Scott's exactly right, which is we don't have this down well enough to be able to say that the absence shows it. But plaintiffs are losing their cases because they don't have the brain evidence to substantiate their claim. So this is a real danger that's already happening and we're already seeing in the legal system. I wouldn't be surprised if that same kind of thing happens in the criminal system, where it's becoming so prevalent for criminal defendants to come into the courtroom with, brain information that if you don't make the claim, then it must be, as Walter put it earlier, that you're one of those people who, you know, is on the other end of the spectrum, who has full control of their behavior and therefore is kind of the worst and the most culpable, which we really can't say, but people are going to start making inferences about.
And I'll just add one more case along the same lines about false negatives. Some people are suggested using brain scans to determine whether patients who have suffered severe brain damage have any consciousness at all. And there you've got a real problem of, well, we didn't detect it, but it is there. In fact, in one study in 2011 where they had 12 controls, three of them showed no signs of consciousness, and yet they walked right out of the scanner because they were the normal subjects. So this problem of us not noticing something that really is there is something that we have to be very, very careful about before we can use this neuroscience in a practical way.
We're talking about neuroscience and criminal justice with Duke professors Nita Farahani, Ahmad Hariri, Walter Sinnott-Armstrong, and Scott Hutel. Coming up next, even if we get good, what are the ethical considerations? Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about neuroscience and criminal justice. Duke professors Nita Farahani, Ahmad Hariri, Walter Sinnott-Armstrong, and Scott Hutel are with me on the program. And if you use neuroscience to read thoughts and predict crimes, that does sound like the movie Minority Report.
Positive for Howard Marks.
Mr. Marks, by mandate of the District of Columbia Pre-Crime Division, I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Dubinos. Take place today, April 22nd. 0800 hours, 4 minutes. Give the man his hat.
Well, let's not kid ourselves. We are arresting individuals who have broken no law.
But they will.
All right, there you go. So arresting you for a future crime. You know, this is a nation that goes to war for a future, you know, mass destruction. So I guess we're not that far off. But, Nita, what are the constitutional protections right now in place to protect the privacy of those thoughts?
Constitutional protections to protect privacy of thoughts. Regrettably, I don't think that there really are any. So my scholarship has been looking to see whether or not the potential candidates, which would be the First Amendment, freedom of speech, maybe there's some sort of correlate like a freedom of thought. The Fourth Amendment, which is a protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. So if you're searching the brain, maybe that would be a problem, except it seems like everything we've learned recently with the NSA and, you know, spying on our emails and our phone calls is not all that protected. And our brain is unlikely to be much more protected depending on how we actually get that information out. And the one people would be most excited about, which is the protection against self-incrimination, which is protected by the Fifth Amendment, that doesn't seem to help us at all either. And that's primarily because the way we've interpreted all of these constitutional protections has always said that we can always take physical evidence from your body. So a handprint, a footprint, a blood sample, a DNA analysis, all of this is fair game. And as long as the method of collecting that information isn't invasive into a person's body, then there's really no constitutional protection that's provided. I think that while I say all of this, that the first time that we actually have the real ability to spy on people's brains, that nobody's going to think that the way in which we've interpreted the Constitution up until now makes any sense if the result is that what's happening in your brain can easily be intercepted by the NSA or anybody else who wants to listen.
Well, is this just an extension, though, of other what we considered fundamental rights? If a person's home is their castle, you can't search it unless you have a warrant. So I can get a warrant to search your brain. Walter, do you think this is fundamentally the same question that has just moved into a different technological realm, or is it a fundamentally different kind of question, searching for evidence in your brain, different than going into your bedroom and going through your drawers?
It's certainly similar in the way that these rights can be waived or overridden in certain extreme cases. But it's very different from searching someone's home and trying to read their intentions or their mind so as to predict crime. If that, for example, is used on a prisoner to know when they should be released, what security level to put them in the prison or something like that, then we're not going into the home of a law-abiding citizen. We've got somebody who's already been convicted of a serious crime, and now we want to figure out whether it's safe to release them or not. That strikes me as a very different question, and people, you know, should be threatened by the police coming into their home unannounced for no good reason, but they should also worry about releasing people too soon for prison when they're not really safe to release. Because right now, the way we're doing it is old-fashioned, to put it mildly. We're trying to investigate these people by looking at them, and that's going to be round. That's going to be leave room for prejudice. Maybe the predictive methods, which might be scary in some way, if you draw the analogy to someone invading your house, actually are going to be extremely helpful in keeping those houses safe from the people who want to invade them.
Well, but given the plasticity and changeability of the brain, if I do the test on Thursday and you trip and hit your head on Friday, how safe are you, or were you ever unsafe?
Which gets back to the earlier comment regarding the reliability of the measure. How stable are these brain markers? A related issue which has been brought up in the comments by Anita and Walter is that we should consider deeply how we respond to the neuroscientific evidence. In other words, if an incarcerated person is scanned and it's determined that they're still at a risk for whatever reason, we should be able to respond to that risk. Right. There's a strong parallel in the mental health field in psychiatry right now where neuroscience is really pushed forward quickly, which is as we identify markers of disease risk, risk for depression, for PTSD, et cetera, are we also advancing our ability to intervene and prevent problems from emerging? And I think that has to be brought into this context as well. If we understand that someone is at greater risk for committing a crime, unlike the precogs predicting it in Minority Report, we hope to have a better recourse than just to lock them up, but rather to change whatever it is about the underlying neurobiology that's leading them, that's predicting this negative outcome, to make it a positive outcome or to at least make it a neutral outcome.
But don't we also risk then prejudicing the life of an individual who is tested once, and what we found is you have a predisposition for a certain thing and that's on the record forever, and now I'm trying to get a job and it's 3 years from then. I mean, is that the downside of – obviously has therapeutic value, but –
Yes. Yeah. Hopefully it becomes part of a larger evidence base. Yeah. It's one additional piece of evidence that helps us make a decision about that person's fate.
Well, then there's the question about the reliability of the evidence. So if we use the example we used of search and seizure, I'm going to go into your home and I found the murder weapon in your drawer. That really doesn't prove that you did it. In other words, I as a jury understand the gun could have gotten there a lot of different ways. Do I look at the evidence from your brain scan showing your intent differently because of my trust in science?
Well, we have some historical examples of this. I mean, you ask the average person on the street about whether a polygraph is informative, and most people would probably think it is. And the polygraph is, frankly, basically essentially a coin flip that has somebody with a lab coat standing over to intimidate you. And the current neuroscience is very different. It has much, much higher predictive power for properly designed tests. There's a real signal being measured there. But that is a different question. How reliable the technique is a different question about whether it's being applied to the right sort of test. So if we wanted to find out, for example, if somebody has poor impulse control, then we could ask the question that might give them, say that yes, they have problems remaining still. But that actually is a different form of impulsivity than, say, non-planning or from the ability to control racing thoughts. Those are distinct constructs, and we don't have yet worked out whether or not somebody who is, for example, has poor planning but good control of racing thoughts should be thought of somebody who is mature or not. And the challenge is not just going to be the neuroscience, but connecting the neuroscience to something psychological that allows us to make a claim in the legal system.
That's because you're applying storytelling language to a whole different body of knowledge, right, and understanding and research. So that raises the question, Anita, what are judges and lawyers in the future? I mean, are we talking about technicians and not people who study the law or whose understanding of the law has to be informed by science?
So it really depends on when we decide to use this information, right? So predictions of dangerousness could happen as soon as a person turns 5 years old. There's some studies that suggest looking over a lifetime of somebody that you can actually start to see the signatures that people claim are indicative of being violent or being aggressive or being a psychopath, that you can start to see that when they're five. So if we're going to be scanning people at 5 years old, we're not really talking about judges and lawyers. We're talking about a really frightening system like the Minority Report. We're talking about intervening long before anybody's ever committed a crime. If we're talking about an example like the one Walter raises, which is a person who's already committed a crime, and now we want to know if a person who's already committed a crime, and usually a serious crime, is somebody who we can release and allow to be reintegrated into society, or if we need to be worried that they're going to do another act of pedophilia or they're going to do another act of violence, then what we're looking at is very different. And we're already doing that. Judges and jurors are already doing that. Parole boards are already doing that. There are already risk predictions that are used for certain types of crimes to figure out if a person is likely to be a violent offender and a repeat offender. And once they've served their prison term, instead of releasing them, we may actually put them in a mental institution and involuntarily civilly commit them. And there have been a lot of questions about whether or not that's punishment, which violates the Constitution. And so far, the Supreme Court has said that isn't punishment. So what we're really talking about in that context, instead of picking up a 5-year-old and isolating them from society and stigmatizing them, is saying we already are doing risk prediction and we're doing it really poorly. We have some measures which are not particularly accurate. Does the neuroscience add something and make it better? And if it does, then maybe we should use it to try to figure out the extension of a person's sentence into a civil commitment or mental health or treatment facility. But I'd be very wary of trying to use these techniques to predict behavior in people who have never committed a crime.
Well, again, though, we get back to this question of how reliable the evidence is. Whenever we call it, whenever we say it's a science and we call it neuroscience, it has this patina of objectivity. But it goes through a process, and the process is testing. And Walter, as you pointed out earlier, there are tests that are, right now a lot of our research is done on one particular kind of individual. And so are we testing broadly enough to give us the results that apply to a broad cross-section of the Earth's population?
Right. If we ever found out that college students at elite universities were not like the rest of us out in society, then a lot of psychology and neuroscience would fall by the wayside because many of the tests are done on weird people. Was it Western, educated, rich, industrialized, and democratic or something?
Right.
And so, we have to look more carefully. So the prison that that I'm working with, Kent Keel, is 50% Hispanic, almost all poor. Many of them have brain injuries from the lives that they lived earlier. And yet the studies that are being applied to them don't use people like that. And so we need to do the neuroscience in a much more fine-grained way on a much more diverse population before we can know what the reliability is in a particular case.
And we know, for instance, there are correlations between the likelihood that someone who has been abused will be an abuser. Is there any way to take that into account, to measure that, as a kind of a baseline? And what would that mean to the criminal justice system if all of those, kind of mitigating factors were now on a bar graph, right?
Yeah. The questions of ecological validity and generalizability are huge. And certainly we have no answers for that. We do try and extend the work in useful directions by looking at diverse populations. But even when we do that, it's still these relatively contrived laboratory measures or pencil and paper questionnaires that we are essentially measuring. To what extent they predict anything about a person's real life and activity in the world remains a huge question mark.
Well, think of the subjectivity just in the initial question. If I say, are you a threat? Threat to whom? Mm-hmm. Here's something in our criminal justice system right now. If you murder somebody in the course of committing a drug transaction, you are not what they call death eligible. Can't get the death penalty for that. Mm-hmm. Because that was you're all involved in something bad. If you kill a shop owner, you are death eligible. So what are the percentage of drug dealers who get killed and what are the percentage in terms of race? Mm-hmm. So what you have in the legal code is a built-in bias that you say is fair because you say, well, they're not death eligible. I have deemed the life of this drug dealer less important than a shop owner, and so the threat to a shop owner is more important. So what do we do about those biases when we ask the question, is this individual a threat?
Well, I think that there's several things in that question. One idea in the question is whether or not when we characterize someone, we're characterizing them in a context-free or context-dependent manner. So we say somebody has poor impulse control or they're racist, and those labels may apply to how they interact with some contexts but may not with others. And I think the key challenge, and people should recognize this when thinking about any sort of neuroscience test, is that when we do the test, we're always testing somebody in some context. And to the extent that we can generalize across contexts, we can strengthen our claims. I think the second very broad issue is that whenever we talk about neuroscience, we're often going to talk about it from the perspective of one individual factor that is being incorporated into a larger system. It is not going to replace traditional methods as implied in the Minority Report clip earlier, that this is both valuable but poses a real challenge for a legal system which isn't used to taking complex sets of probabilistic evidence and wrapping them all together in some way to reach a conclusion. For the foreseeable future, any measurements of the brain are always going to be probabilistic. Sometimes very good and probabilistic, but still not going to be perfect.
So, Nita, it sounds to me like public expectations about the value of neuroscience and how it can be used have to evolve and mature along with the science itself in order for it to be useful. Isn't that a fair statement?
Absolutely. I think the public, lawyers, judges, you know, the problem is many of the people who are coming into the courtroom and hearing this complex science don't have the scientific background to understand what any of it means. And, you know, you have pretty pictures with pretty colors and people with lab coats who speak in technical jargon that you don't understand. And people oftentimes do overcredit and misunderstand what it is that they're hearing. So I think one of the most important things that we can do is to improve education about what neuroscience is, what it tells us about individuals, what it doesn't tell us about individuals, and how much of a gap there is right now in our understanding of human behavior and psychology.
Walter?
I think that's absolutely right. But a judge is never going to be able to be a professional neuroscientist. They've got, you know, not enough time. And so I think there also has to be a change in relying more on experts. The judge or the parole board or whoever's making the decision in the legal system needs to turn to experts who are not being hired by one side or the other and get information in a critical way from somebody who will say, no, it's not definitely this, it's not definitely that, we don't know yet.
Well, but that does presume that the legal system looks like it does now going forward. But can you imagine a time when it is really a scientific process where the whole thing takes place in a lab with neurobiologists and experts in that field who can actually measure these results and come up with what they consider pretty confidently the definitive solution?
I think it's critical that the experts that the legal system will start to look towards in this future take the blinders off and appreciate and recognize that their science is going to have a larger impact, and to reframe and replace the lines of confidence. What is happy amongst a group of scientists as a significant finding would never reach the level of confidence that we would need to start to influence decision making and the futures of hundreds, if not thousands, of people who get tied up in the legal system. Experts have to become sensitive to that.
Scott?
Well, I think the legal system will look from the outside largely as it does now for the foreseeable future. But things behind the scene are going to change, and if you don't know what you're looking for, you might not notice it. So, for example, the way we do lineups in our state and other states has changed because people realize that the prior ways of doing it introduce psychological biases in the people trying to identify people from the lineup. And there are better and more valid ways of doing lineups, and there are worse ways of doing lineups. And we're moving toward a better way of doing lineups. That is something that you may not notice unless you're looking for it. And I suspect that'll happen in many ways, that the neuroscience will be one of several big pushes to shape aspects of the legal system. Even though it looks superficially the same, it's going to get incrementally better in certain areas.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Scott Hutel is a professor of psychology and neuroscience. Nita Farahani is a professor of law, genome sciences, and policy, as well as philosophy. Walter Sinnott Armstrong is a professor of practical ethics. And Ahmad Hariri is a professor of psychology and neuroscience, all at Duke University. Thank you all so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director, and this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.